think we can say without a doubt that this study is about one of the greatest men who ever lived. And it's not just our opinions. We learn that from God himself, because God in Ezekiel is going to name three righteous people, and Daniel's one of them. Then he's going to name a wise man, and he'll name Daniel, as he'll refer to Daniel when he talks about a wise man. So he really was a great man. About all we know about the period of captivity is from Ezekiel and Daniel. However, I thought it was interesting you quoted Psalm 79, and I want to ask you a question on that here in a moment, when I ask you a couple of questions on that psalm. But I thought that was interesting that we can actually get some other information on the captivity as well from a source that I hadn't really expected. But Daniel was, I want to say one thing about this lion's den incident. He was probably in his 80s. He wasn't just a boy when he was thrown into the lion's den. I thought that would be something that might shake some people up. But he was probably, he was in his 80s at least, probably, when that lion's den thing occurred. And, you know, he grew up when Josiah was alive. And he heard the preaching of Zephaniah. He would hear the preaching of Jeremiah, no doubt. He would know Habakkuk. He would know Ezekiel, I believe, in captivity. He perhaps could have known Nahum, maybe Obadiah as well. So he grew up on some good preaching, and he was around that all his life. But let me ask you these questions now. Psalm 79 is attributed to Asaph. And why do you think that's the case, number one? And number two, Daniel, he retains his Hebrew name, and these three companions that you mentioned, we only know them basically from their Babylonian name. And I'd like to see if you knew perhaps why that might be the case. And then I'd like to ask you when you think Daniel was written.
Okay. I'll simply say this on Psalm 79 again. It might be a careful investigation has me taking that out of its proper place. I don't really know about all the historical setting. I was just taking that in terms of the expression of what I see as the dilemma of that time. So that's, you know, I could just... I utilized them in passages not because necessarily I understood well the historical reference of them, but because, like you said, wherefore should the heathen then say? So, you know, you may know much more there than that. I may have abused that much.
No, I actually think that is a captivity psalm, but I can't figure out why it's attributed to the acid.
Well, it's obvious you shouldn't ask me after what I've just said. You know, here's a psalm that probably was written after captivity that's just, in terms of thinking about the condition of God's people and their faith, talk about something lending information is Psalms 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. There they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? What an amazing statement. You know, God's people are a people of songstress joy, even a heathen who preferred, of course, his rock music. What have I said? Oh, my. Even the heathen who enjoyed a different kind of music must have enjoyed the melodious voices of God. And they said, hey, sing us one of those songs. Man, we'd love to hear. But the content of the song, all that it meant for a child of God. How is he going to sing a song? this, it just catches the heart of your people. Sorry about that. I knew if I did that, your other questions. Sorry.
Why do you think Daniel's Hebrew name was retained and not his Babylonian? And then these three companions, there we know them best by their Babylonian name, and then the date.
Why do you think it's because of basically in the narrative we have the interaction of the conversations? Now, isn't it also in Daniel 5? You know, when they came back in, they referred to Daniel, wasn't it, by his Babylonian name? And that was because it was the heathens he was talking about. I would just think it's probably because of the recording of what the conversation was and the people involved in the conversation. A date. Five, 38, 36, in that general range.
Other questions? George Batty?
Scripture seems to indicate that Hezekiah should have known better than to show his house to all these Babylonians that came. Why should he have known better? Is it just simply the scriptures that taught don't have an alliance with heathen nations? Was that an alliance that he was making that... when you just read through, it just looks like here's some nice guys that came by and I'm just showing them around, giving them a sightseeing tour. Is there more to it than that?
You know, George, this would be speculative on my part, what I kind of think of. It just seems to be, it's not a necessary inference, but it kind of seems to be inferred, you know, like, that was kind of greasing his ego a little. And he was kind of raised up with pride, like, hey, these guys are country far away, and I just want to let them know I got something over here. But that's, it seems maybe that pride thing, you know, when you think how that constant theme about pride and governments and men is found throughout the Bible. You know, Jesus resists, he resists, God resists the proud, and we have these examples. That's just a poor guess by a horse.
Another question. Why is it that after the captivity, Israel is not inclined to worship idols anymore? What was it that happened in that captivity that burned that desire out of them?
Well, I imagine one part, of course, would have been the actual captivity and the punishment. But the other thing is, you know, to turn around in the face of like the Medo-Persians and have God take them back. That must have finally been an argument that said, fellas, we know there's only one true God. And that verse I quoted from Ezekiel, he said, He is the Lord. It seems like it finally got that over to him. And maybe let's think about it like this. In Isaiah, the 44th chapter and the 45th chapter, we have Isaiah prophesying of the Lord's, he called him a wonder shepherd when he spoke of Cyrus. Somebody help me. Here we are a long, long time before Cyrus. And Isaiah makes this prophecy that there will be this fellow named Cyrus who will be the Lord's shepherd, raised up by the Lord, and he will set forth an edict that will let God's people go. Maybe that had a great effect on him. That's just an astounding prophecy. I mean, Offhand, I can only think of one other prophecy where a particular man was named related to King Josiah. And maybe that finally got the message over that these powers and these idols and all these things that these worldly powers entertain, there's only one God. The captivity didn't show on that. Made me think of something, going back to talking about Daniel's position. You know, I guess you could say of Daniel, he was a legend in his time. When Ezekiel names him, he names him with Noah and Job. Here's a contemporary of Ezekiel. He names him with Noah and Job. This guy's a legend in his time. And also in the book, you know, he says, "Thou art the beloved," or something of that sort. I read someplace that that terminology is only used of one other Bible character and it's spoken in Mary. But Daniel was a man of great honor, and he well should have been. His behavior throughout the book of Daniel was just, well, it's unreal, isn't it? Unless you're faithful. He purposed, when his enemies wanted to get to him, when they wanted to get to him, they said, "If we're going to come up with a plot, we can't go through his books. We've got to do something that will make him violate God's law, the law of the king, by getting him. He will not surrender his convictions of God's law." His reputation, you know, they turned it inside out 100 times because they wanted that position that foreigner had. They stated in Daniel 6, "If we're going to get anything on this guy, we're going to have to do it through spiritual convictions." One other thing, I'll quit for associating. You know, Daniel's blend of courage and compassion, I think so, maybe. You know, here he gets this, he's supposed to interpret this dream of this king. And it just sets him back. He wasn't arrogant. He's taken back. Old king, old Ned knows that this guy has an affection for him. At the same time, he had the courage to tell him. Finally, the king says, "Go ahead. Just tell it to me." When you blend that kind of respect and affection and truth together, that's speaking the truth in love. What a...
You know, this idea of why it was wrong or why Isaiah rebuked Hezekiah for showing the Babylonians what he had. You know, we're friends with the Russians right now. But Bush and Clinton, they didn't get so excited with Gorbachev and Yeltsin that they said, "Hey, bring all your generals in here and we'll tell you all of our military secrets." It's, if I can use the word, it's stupid diplomacy. We still, 2 weeks ago or so, we kicked out a Russian diplomat because of spying. I suppose we're still trying to spy on Russia, and they're still trying to spy on us. It is, it's not wise. And Hezekiah showed a lapse of governorship, I suppose you could say, by letting them know that. But Isaiah wasn't the first one that anyway told him that the Babylonians were going to overthrow. Micah, we learned today, already had. So that even made it, you might say, stupider. Because here you've got, it's already predicted from Micah that the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, are going to come in someday and they're going to overthrow Jerusalem. And here's Hezekiah, he's supposed to know about that, and he shows him all of his military secrets. So I think there's several reasons why it was a very foolish thing. And as far as the captivity curing them, well, this was a... All you have to do is go back to the history books and see what happened during captivity. It was horrible what they suffered. And they knew why they suffered. Everybody knew the reason for that. We studied Habakkuk today, and God said, the righteous, the just, will live through that because of their faith. Not very many people lived through the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. The people who did were mainly righteous people. They knew why they had suffered as well. And so when they went over there, they had had, I suppose, it cured them for all time from at least outward idolatry. And another thing that it caused, incidentally, the captivity is the invent of the synagogue as well. You might want to comment on that.
I won't comment on it. Talking about the synagogue, what was the phrase you used?
Well, the synagogue came into existence during the years of captivity.
Yeah.
And so I just thought you might want to comment on that.
Came into existence and played a great providential role, you know, as far as down the road, the gospel, gathering together people that when the gospel went out, they knew where to find them, both among the Jews and the Gentiles. Talking about, one thing we need to remember, you know, is the governments of men come, and the governments of men go. You know, of course, a large part of the religious world today has reached a point they don't preach sin. They changed the whole terminology in the Bible, and they actually believe that the hand of God will change the world through these political reformations and things of this nature. And we got to reckon how much folly there is in that. And this book of Daniel brings this to us, and let me read Daniel 2:35. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, and no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. We should recognize, as feeble as the Lord's kingdom looks to us, as ugly as we are, with all the blemishes we have, His kingdom is. And the kingdoms of men that seem so powerful that we're going to remove it, they're gone. They're gone. And this should bring back to us God's faithfulness, which of course in response should come from us, faithfulness unto Him.
You know, I think all these prophets we've studied and we will study show us the sovereignty of God. He's in control of everything. But no two prophets do it more, I believe, than Ezekiel and Daniel, these two captivity prophets. And they're going to use that phrase a lot, especially in Ezekiel. You'll just read it every two or three sentences, it seems like. But I think Daniel is saying, Ezekiel and Daniel are trying to give hope to this remnant who were faithful. They escaped because they were righteous. Most of these people were righteous people. But they're both trying to give encouragement to them. And you just think about it, if you're in their shoes, you've tried to remain faithful. You survived barely because of your faithfulness. And now you're in captivity. And you know why you're in captivity. And you can see the Lord is sovereign. Everything He said would happen, happened. So now, Daniel's saying, what I'm saying in the future is going to happen too. And that would give great encouragement to these people over there in Babylon. They would know that not all is lost. And they would be reminded of the 70 years that they would be in captivity. I think the faithful ones would. And Ezekiel, of course, is going to mention that as well. But God is sovereign. If probably the two books that emphasize it more than any other in the Bible are the two captivity books.
There are circumstances limiting to that because of what the position of God's people is.